Drive Time on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Zurich. For pensions, protection, savings and investments. At Zurich, we deal in peace of mind.
Welcome back to this special edition of Drive Time with me, Barry Lenehan. Tributes continue to pour in from across the globe for Pope Francis in America. President Trump has ordered flags to be lowered to half-mast in sympathy following the passing of Pope Francis. But to look back at his legacy, I'm joined in studio by Breida O'Brien, Catholic commentator and columnist with the Irish Times, and from Rome by Father Michael Collins, author of Pope Francis, a photographic portrait of the people's Pope. Thank you so much to you both for joining me. Breida, how would you describe his papacy?
Well, I suppose when I think back on his papacy, there's two images that kind of sum up his appeal to me. One was very early on in his papacy, when there was a man with neurofibromatosis, which is a very disfiguring disease, and he stopped the Pope mobile and reached down and embraced him, which I think was just a beautiful, you know, wordless moment. And then the other one was at the start of COVID, when he was in that rainwashed square on his own, and there were so few people, so few leaders, international leaders, that would have had the authority or the credibility to actually stand there and kind of give a message of peace and hope to the entire world. So I think he has left a complex and really interesting legacy.
And the fact that he passed just hours after giving the Easter blessing in St. Peter's Square, he was always somebody on the go, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, that actually is, you've touched on a pet bugbear of mine. I wish he took more holidays. And even, I know it was a beautiful thing for him to go to the prison on Holy Thursday to greet the prisoners. But, you know, in the crazy world that we live in, where people are overextended, like, he never used Castel Gandolfo, the traditional holiday home of the Popes. And I think perhaps he pushed himself too hard. But I presume he felt he had a lot to achieve and not too much time to achieve it in.
Yeah, he tried to implement several reforms, but he also met quite a lot of opposition as well. Did he ultimately go far enough, as perhaps he would have anticipated, with reforms around the involvement of women and the gay community in particular?
Well, I think that he has advanced things much further for women than anyone else. For example, Sister Natalie Beckhart being the basically in charge, you know, in the Vatican, the first woman ever to have a post as high as that. Then he had women voting at the Synod. Now, I know for a lot of people they say too little, not enough, but these are very significant reforms in themselves. And even he had this kind of kitchen cabinet of cardinals, which eventually were 9 cardinals, and for the last meetings that they had, there were always 3 women also present. Often one of the meetings had to be structured around one woman breastfeeding her baby. So there definitely were strides taken in
that
direction.
Gone further, some commentators perhaps saying perhaps he could in some of the articles published today.
Well, I know that what he did not make everybody happy. But, for example, people who are pushing for the ordination of women. But in my view, that's quite a clericalist way of looking at the church. The majority of women are not going to be seeking ordination, but they do want a voice. They do want to be heard. And even the majority of lay people are not going to be seeking ordination. So I think what he did with these kind of, they were more than symbolic gestures. They were significant gestures. I think he was pointing to the importance of women. And of course, there is a long way to go. Even in our own country, there are roles within the church that women could carry out without ever touching the question of ordination.
And I'll bring in Father Michael Collins in a moment. But what of the gay community? Of course, there was the "who am I to judge" comment early in his papacy, but also the alleged homophobic slur made in private as well. Do you think Francis's church was more open to the LGBTQ plus community?
I was very sorry about that slur. I think it was a terrible pity, because I do think he had a genuine openness. You know, his famous saying, as you mentioned, "Who am I to judge if a person is of goodwill and is seeking the Lord," which is a very biblical way of looking at things. Don't judge the motivations of others. But I think in general, his pastoral care of people who are gay or same sex attracted, I think, was important.
Father Michael Collins in Rome, you've written 2 books about Pope Francis, and am I right in saying you actually gave him a copy of the book which he signed for you?
Well, yes, I happened to be at a meeting a few years ago, and I had a book with me, and I gave it to him, and he looked at, flicked through a few pages of it and thanked me and asked for my address. And then about 2 weeks later, I got a very kind letter from him, which I presume he'd written or directed to be written and then signed fraternally Francis. But I agree with Breda's summation of the Pope as well. I think there's always going to be people who will say, oh, he could have gone further, he could have done more, etc., etc. But today is a day when we pray for the passing of a Christian soul, and many of us have formed a bond with him. So we're saddened and sorry to say goodbye to a wonderful person. And indeed, over the last few weeks, I've been very affected by the way he embraced his illness. He got sick at the beginning of February, and he was seated at a ceremony, an outdoor ceremony, which was connected with the Jubilee, which the Catholic Church is celebrating at the moment. And shortly after that, he developed bronchitis and pneumonia and was admitted on the 14th of February to the hospital. I say it must have been immensely frustrating for him to lose his voice, to be struggling with his breath, and to deal with that. And as we know now, the doctors told us on two occasions they considered ending the treatment. There was little more that they could do. And he gave instructions, no, keep going, see what you can do. And I'm very impressed by that on a human level, because there's been so many tributes to him, and many people have their own little tiny shelf of memories like I would. But at the same time, when I look back now over the last few weeks, and even yesterday to the point of appearing for the traditional Urbi et Orbi, the blessing to the city and to the world, which the Popes traditionally give on Christmas Day and on Easter Day, I think it was lovely that he was able to do that. But, you know, on a human level, I think many people today are just saying goodbye to somebody who touched them in many, many ways. And everybody feels that he was interested in them in a particular way, even to the point, I'm remembering back at the beginning of the pontificate, when so many people wrote to him, giving him good wishes, etc. Then bit by bit, they were telling him their life story. And he'd pick up the phone if they put a mobile phone number in, and he just introduced himself as Francis. And obviously at the beginning people thought there was somebody mimicking him, but it turned out no, he would do this for an hour every evening. And then his other thing was, on a Sunday afternoon, he'd contact his sister in Argentina, whom he hasn't seen for 12 years, and any other of his friends from Argentina. So he kind of had this little ritual that he did for himself. And he said the reason he wanted to live in a house full of about 90 other people was that he felt he'd be isolated if he was surrounded by pomp and ceremony. And that's another thing which he's tried to do, bringing in a more general inclusion of every voice in the church. And it's had a very cumbersome translation as a synod on synodality, because nobody really knows what synodality means. It's an old Greek word for walking together. So what he's tried to do is he's tried, in a certain sense, I think, to resemble more the Reformed churches, where the laity, the clergy, and everybody has a more balanced voice. And that became very obvious last year when he decided to change the synod of bishops, which is every 2 or 3 years when the bishops of the world send representatives to Rome to discuss various issues. And he actually, without abolishing it, he changed it completely by inviting people of all ages and backgrounds to contribute, not only Catholics, but people from other faiths as well, to contribute what they thought would be a useful message from the Catholic Church. And it wasn't that he was trying to change the church, but I think he was trying to make the message of the gospel more pertinent today and more accessible to people.
And synodality was his signature project, wasn't it? The signature project of his papacy. Do you think he achieved all he set out to achieve back in 2013?
No, he couldn't have, because he had 12 years and they were packed years. He'd got travels abroad, he'd got work at home, he'd got all sorts of things. You can't really expect, and I felt very sorry for him also in the last few days, because I thought to myself, well, look, he's not going to be able to continue for much longer. And clearly yesterday he was so ill. And I was wondering in my mind, would he try and make an announcement in May by Pentecost in order for an election to take place and be concluded before the 29th of June, which is the feast of St. Peter and Paul, the patrons of Rome, a big day in Rome. And then the kind of the Italian world all seems to slow down for the heat of the summer. But in a sense, he was spared that. And I think it was pretty wonderful that he died in office doing what he really loved. As Brita said, he never took a holiday, didn't take a day off. Even when he was back in Buenos Aires, he never, the whole, all his confreres, etc., would take their annual leave. He never did that. He was just a workaholic, and probably he overdid it a little bit too much.
Brita, what of his communication style?
I think he had a very kind of warm, almost folksy style. I have to say that I did take a breath every time he got on a plane because I wasn't quite sure what he would say. And as I mentioned earlier, sometimes that folksy style was a bit too, you know, familiar or whatever. But I think he had an ability, despite the fact that he only had Spanish and Italian, which is unusual in the light of the previous popes who spoke up to, you know, some of them, John Paul had, I think, 11 languages. He managed to communicate a warmth and a concern and a kind of a solidity, I think, in the way that he was, not just in relation. And much more, I think he'll be evaluated as being much more in continuity than in rupture with the previous popes. Like, we think of him as the Pope of climate change, but Benedict was the one who made, you know, the Vatican kind of carbon neutral and so on. So I do think his communication style, this is possibly heresy, and maybe Michael should cover his ears, but I don't think he was as great a writer in any way as several of the previous popes.
Yeah, and I appreciate, as Michael said, some people, they have a bond with Pope Francis, they are mourning his loss, but others are using the passing of a pope to maybe reflect on the last few years and look forward to the next few years. And the criticism which has come up for some was that some of Pope Francis's communications were a bit ambiguous or lacked clarity. What would you say to that?
I suppose that's always a danger when you're addressing the entire world. There are times when he was absolutely straight down the line, and for example, in his defence of all human beings' right to life, no matter what their stage of development, from the womb to old age, he was absolutely unambiguous in relation to those kind of things. But I suppose there were times when, you know, literally a footnote in something could be interpreted by some people one way and some people another way. And that's difficult, I think, to avoid. But I think in general, his priorities were clear, what he wanted. I think what he wanted was a church of the poor for the poor and a church of the developing world. If you look at his appointments, so many of them are from the global south now, because he was very aware that the concerns there are very different to the concerns of the West. And I think he wanted to focus attention there. And I think that will be a legacy.
We obviously had the 29 years of John Paul II and then Pope Benedict. But how relevant do you think Pope Francis made the church during his papacy?
I think what I've been talking about, I think it actually, you're looking at a rapidly secularizing West. And he was very concerned about things like demographic decline in the West, but he was also very aware of the vibrancy of the church in other places like Africa, and that the concerns there were entirely different. Like at the famous Synod on Synodality, only the church would come up with a title like that. Polygamy was a huge concern, for example, which it isn't in the West. So I think he had his finger very much on the pulse of where the church is thriving and growing. Even appointing Anders Arborelius in Sweden, where the church is growing in Sweden, believe it or not. And he's the first cardinal since the Reformation. So I think he, the first cardinal appointed since the Reformation. So I think he had a vision of where the church is growing and where the church is developing.
Briefly, Michael, Pope Francis rejecting many of the rituals, centuries old rituals, in his wishes for his funeral. Do you think that humility, if you will, is what created the bond with so many?
Absolutely, yeah. Definitely, because so many people that I've had messages from today, just friends and acquaintances, you know, contacting me. I don't know why, but we're all kind of talking. As I mentioned before, he is a spiritual leader, a spiritual father, and we do have a bond with him. I think that's exactly the reason why people feel the loss. The fact that he got into the car and went down to Centre Rome to buy a pair of spectacles one day instead of sending for the optician to come to the Vatican, like, you know, in times gone by. Yeah, and now the fact that he's decided to trim down the burial ceremony. As he said, I'm just the Bishop of Rome, so I should be buried like every other bishop, like every other Christian, in the ground without any great fuss and fanfare. Now, the problem with that is he wasn't going to get away with it. He couldn't completely scrap everything. And he often lamented privately that he lived in this golden cage of the Vatican, that it, with all its beautiful frescoes and works by Renaissance artists and Baroque architects, etc. It is beautiful, but to a degree, it's like living in a Hollywood set. And in fact, that movie Conclave has probably captured that as well. So the cardinals live in this this world where they've got to wear costumes, and you know, there's a certain way of doing things, and that's very much an Italian dictate. So I think he found it quite difficult to push through, but I think people loved when you know, he did such pretty normal things for a leader to do. Very, very difficult to break out of all that bureaucracy and also to be the leader, a respected leader of the bureaucracy. And so he tried his best, that's all you can say.
In 2018, we remember he travelled to Ireland. He apologised for the crimes committed by the church and, of course, issues around abuse in schools run by religious institutions to the fore here, even since 2018 as well. To what extent did those claims of abuse, both in Ireland and elsewhere, cast a shadow for Pope Francis?
Well, they've cast a shadow on every Catholic, so they'd cast a shadow on him as well. It's a shame, probably not only to Catholics, but to every human being, to think that they would injure a child or a vulnerable person, even if it's an adult person who's got disabilities of any kind. So I think it reflects badly on all of us as humans that we're capable of doing that. We can do it in a domestic or in an educational setting, but it's something which I think probably reflects badly on all of us, not just the Pope.
Breda, the conclave in at least 15 days from here. What sort of Pope do you expect next?
Oh, I have no idea who the next Pope is going to be. And I don't know if anyone really does. What I would love is somebody who was in continuity with the great tradition of the church, but also had the openness to the modern world. Pope Francis said a beautiful prayer at the beginning of the Synod, where he said, we don't want a rigid church which is armed against the world and looking backwards. We don't want a lukewarm church which is enthralled to the fashions of the age. We don't want a tired church that looks inward on itself. So what we need now is a leader who will continue all that was good about Francis.
Another reformer or somebody from the more traditionalist wing?
I think it's a mistake, actually, to kind of categorise people in those kind of binary ways, you know, traditionalist or reformer, because in many ways Pope Francis was more traditionalist than most previous popes. Like, no other pope talked about the devil as much as Pope Francis did, or about his mother Mary on Tyre of Knots or St. Joseph. I think what we need is someone really deeply in tune with the Holy Spirit and what the church needs now.
OK, well, Breda O'Brien, Catholic commentator and columnist with the Irish Times, and in Rome, Father Michael Collins, author of Pope Francis, A Photographic Portrait of the People's Pope. Thank you both so much for joining us on Drive Time this evening. Sus Beag, back in a moment.